This month's sermon theme is forgiveness. I'm a bit of a troublemaker, as some of you know, so I want to talk today about what's forgiven and who's forgiven. Now, we all know what's forgiven, even in UU churches where we don't talk much about it. Calvin Coolidge, our 30th president, was also a man who didn't talk much. At a reception one Sunday, a lady found that Coolidge had attended church that morning, which wasn't something he always did. She asked him what had been the subject of the sermon. "Sin," said Coolidge. And after a silent interval, she asked, "Well, what did the preacher have to say about sin?" "He was against it." Well, this afternoon, after you can also say about today's sermon that was about sin, and that the speaker was not against it, but for it, or at least for exploring the idea of sin. Now, the reason that Unitarian Universalists don't talk about sin is because sin, and especially original sin, and the punishment for sin and the atonement for sin are doctrines that we reject and avoid. But no matter how positive our view of human nature, we all know that we are fallible. We all sometimes fall short or commit acts that we ourselves judge as wrong. And we know that there are real consequences of our mistakes, regrets. Even guilt and remorse are felt in every life. When we think about this aspect of human life, the metaphors or symbols given us by our culture profoundly shape how we think and how we feel. They're not just rhetorical embellishments to the thought. They are what we use to think with. So today I'm going to look at three resonant metaphors of sin and salvation in our Judeo-Christian background. It's the one I know best. There's sin as a defiling stain, sin as a burden, and sin as a debt. There are other ideas too, but we'll just look at these because they're maybe a little bit primitive or thing-like or almost physical. First one is defilement, or the stain. In early Israelite religion, defilement was caused by circumstantial evil more than moral evil. It was something that the person incurred inadvertently or without full intention. Could be touching a corpse, childbirth, nothing immoral about that. Menses, could be something that happened to someone, a skin disease. Lameness, paralysis. In the Hebrew scriptures, the text from the end of Exodus, all of Leviticus, the first parts of Numbers, much of Deuteronomy, I'm assuming those are your faves, give the rules of purity and impurity in worship, in sexuality, eating, sickness, and the violent spilling of blood. There's supposed to be 613 commandments there. And the question kind of arises, is there some sort of system to all these commandments? There's a clue in God's holiness, which humans are supposed to recreate in themselves. And more than just moral goodness, the holy embraces ideas of separateness, wholeness, and completeness. In the book of Leviticus on the qualifications for being a priest, it says, "Say to Aaron," who is sort of the ancestor of the priests, "None of your descendants throughout their generations who has a blemish may approach to offer the bread of his God. For no one who has a blemish shall draw near, a man blind or lame, or one who has an injured foot or an injured hand." And it goes on, but you get the drift. And about sacrificial animals, over and over it's repeated, the animals must be without blemish. And behind the dietary rules about what you can eat, there's a similar idea that food animals should be perfect, complete instances of three types: those that move on the land, those that move through the water, and those that move through the air. Now, for herding people like the ancient Israelites, cattle, sheep, and goats were the normal food animals. And all three of these have cloven hoofs and chew the cud. So these normal animals are clean. Pigs, cloven hoofs but don't chew a cud. Or camels, they chew the cud but their hoofs are not cloven, are sort of considered defective or half-breed or monstrous animals, and so they're unclean. And similar distinctions hold for the birds of the air versus birds that don't fly, like ostriches, or flying animals that aren't birds, like bats, and for fish versus other aquatic animals. So you have this idea of wholeness or being intact, true to your category or true to your intact within your body. So defilement arises in contrast to holiness by breaching the boundary between the body and the outside, or the boundary of a natural category. Uncleanness results from bodily leaking or spilling, from mixing and confusion, from being defective as judged against an ideal. And that last phrase sort of indicates the feeling that the unclean person feels before God. They feel unworthy, defective, incomplete, and dirty. To become presentable before the Lord, there are two ritual means of purification. There's ritual bathing, kind of makes sense. If you're dirty, you need to wash. The other one is maybe a little bit more of a stretch. It's animal sacrifice, with a lot of emphasis on blood. For just one out of hundreds of example texts, we could take the instructions for the Day of Atonement in Leviticus chapter 16. First, there are some instructions that Aaron the high priest should divest himself of his clothing, ritually bathe his body in water, and then put on holy linen clothing. Second are the instructions for sacrificing. First, a ram as a burnt offering to the Lord, then a bullock to purify the priest and his family, and finally, of two goats, one chosen by lot for the sin offering for all of Israel. More about the second goat later. Some later Hebrew texts extend ritual bathing beyond ritual impurities to moral sins. But the decisive extension of symbolic bathing to moral sins occurs with John the Baptist, because he's preaching a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. So baptism becomes a symbol of forgiveness of sins, and obviously the central sacrament of Christianity. It's possible that animal sacrifice is an even more influential form of ritual purification. It certainly was central to the ancient Israelites and the ancient Jewish cult for thanksgiving, for fulfilling a vow, for purification, and sometimes for the forgiveness of sins. And there was always kind of an idea in the background of substitutionary punishment. And obviously the symbolism is central to Christianity, the death of Christ being the sacrifice that purifies all Christians. Okay, weird ideas, all right? Do we see any similar ideas of defilement and purification in our own modern secular and scientific lives today? Setting aside whether we approve or not, you know, just trying to think of some things. What about fear of food contamination, not just by pathogens, but by unnatural or bad ingredients or by moral impurity? Thinking here of all kinds of non-medical diets, whether the motives are morality, unnaturalness, health, or physical appearance. There's a big purity issue in our household. What to do with recyclables contaminated by food traces? The rule is truly worthy of its own passage in Leviticus. Let's see. Never put paper and tinfoil in the garbage. They go in the recycling. Unless soiled by food, in which case the food soiled paper goes in the compostable kitchen and yard waste, but the food soiled tin foil does go in the garbage after all. Can we think of any other examples, perhaps of modern situations where we, maybe of bigger import, where we symbolically wash away or shed contact with something that's harmful or immoral or unclean? One that I've been thinking about quite a bit lately is the divestment of investments in fossil fuel producers for its moral symbolism, because the economic effect is pretty negligible. What about purification through substitutionary blood sacrifice? Well, some pretty dire possibilities occur to me. What about the upholding of the death penalty? Even in the face of an uncomfortable number of cases in which it's been discovered that the person sentenced to death were innocent? Or what about keeping us pure and true to our Constitution and its Second Amendment by the blood sacrifice of innocent children? Let's go on to the second symbol of sin. You remember that was burden. Maybe you don't remember, but I just reminded you. Bearing a heavy weight or burden is actually the main metaphorical verb used with the Old Testament noun for serious sin. Now, a lot of people, even people who are pretty familiar with the Bible, are surprised by this. The cause is a translation difficulty. The Hebrew phrase, commonly translated by forgiveness of sins, would be better rendered as bearing away the burden of sins. There are a few Old Testament texts where this burden idea surfaces, even in translation. For example, in Psalms 38, in the Revised Standard Version, it says, "My iniquities have gone over my head. They weigh like a burden too heavy for me." Or Isaiah chapter 1, verse 4, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity." But the most striking example is back in that rite for the Day of Atonement, back to Leviticus. After Aaron, the high priest, divests himself, he takes a ritual bath, he puts on linen clothing, he sacrifices a ram as a burnt offering and a bullock to purify himself and his house, then two goats are presented. And he chooses one by lot. He has this sort of pouch on him and has maybe a couple stones, it's not clear. But he chooses one of them as the sin offering for slaughter. And when he's done with that sacrifice, it says, "Aaron shall lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat and confess over him all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions, all their sins, and he shall put them upon the head of the goat and send him away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who is in readiness. The goat shall bear all their iniquities upon him to a solitary land, and he shall let the goat go in the wilderness." Well, this is the famous scapegoat, who escapes sacrifice so he can bear the sins of Israel away into the wilderness where God can't see them. In the New Testament, the best-known passage using this burden symbolism is the saying of Jesus in Matthew, "Come unto me, all ye who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Now, it's interesting that that passage actually doesn't explicitly connect the burdens with sin, but subsequent references to this passage in Christian piety certainly do make that connection. The strongest one that I know of is in the hymn that was written in 1855, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. You remember how that goes? All our sins and griefs to bear. Are you weary, heavy laden, cumbered with a load of care? So what about modern cases of putting the burden on an innocent to bear away into the wilderness? I suggest that the deportation of undocumented immigrants, who not only bear our manual labor burdens, but are made symbolically to bear away the burden of our economic woes across our borders. And what about economic austerity policies that make a whole country's economy, but disproportionately the poor and less powerful, bear the burden for the sins, even the crimes, of a few banksters? Okay, third symbol. Before expounding on the third symbol of sin as economic debt, let's just talk about debt as debt. You know, no symbolism involved here. Debt's been around a long time. There's a new book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. It's by an anthropologist, not an economic expert. We actually have debt records on clay tablets from the Sumerians. And from the beginning, snowballing debt, unmitigated by any restraint or relief mechanisms, has caused huge problems for debtors who are unable to pay. Increasing economic and social inequality, extreme debtor poverty, debtors' loss of land and homes, debt servitude or slavery, and debtors' prisons. And the surprising thing is, even though it's been 5,000 years, these issues are frequent throughout history, and they're still with us today in some form. It's been claimed that the main form of unrest and agitation within societies throughout history has been the demand for debt forgiveness. Ancient Israel actually addressed this problem, this need for debt relief, with the custom of the Year of Jubilee. The Jubilee year is a kind of financial reboot that occurs either every 7 years, according to Deuteronomy, or every 50 years, according to Leviticus. And in the Jubilee year, all debts are canceled or forgiven. All original owners return to land that they lost to debt. And all debt slaves go free. Historically, the idea of debt as symbolizing sin displaces the metaphor of burden in the Second Temple period. It's after the Jews who were in Babylonian exile were freed by the Persians and returned to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. The debt symbolism for sin actually comes in from Aramaic, which, as the Persian Empire's official language, became the second, the day-to-day language of all Jews. And in Aramaic, the same word means both debt and sin. Use the same word. And under the influence of Aramaic, all Hebrew writings from about 540 BC to 70 AD use debt and debt cancellation symbolism for sin and forgiveness. And New Testament Greek was also shaped by this Aramaic construal of sin as debt. The New Testament, I'm just going to remind this, but you'll find all sorts of examples. It's just permeated with economic metaphors. You can probably think of some. You just think of the sayings and parables ascribed to Jesus in the Gospels. But the most famous example is the Lord's Prayer, which in Matthew's version in chapter 6 says, "Forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors." This basic idea is found in several other New Testament texts and is explicated later in Matthew by the parable of the unforgiving servant, which I was the reading today. And after Christ, the Christian message could be summarized this way. It's always dangerous to try to summarize a whole religion, but here we go. Sins are debts to God. Our debt is too great to be paid off by our own punishment. Christ's suffering and death is for the remission of our sins. That word remission is interesting. It's sort of like remittance. As a matter of fact, it really is the same word. Paying off our debt, purchasing our bond, and so freeing us. If you have problems with that summary, see me afterwards. So, what about modern instances of sin as debt and of forgiveness as debt redemption? There are things about that we wouldn't accept today about the traditional Christian symbolism of redemption. The idea is that sin debt is owed to God rather than to our fellow creatures who've been wronged, that debt can only be paid off by punishment, and that Christ's suffering and death somehow made that pay off for us. But sin debt does have some symbolic advantages. Debt, just like sin and burden, does point to the effect of sin on the debtor, on the sinner. But it also says there's another party that's wrong to whom something is owed. Oh, by the way, our word ought, as in what we morally ought to do, is just the past tense of the Old English for owe. So debt also sheds light, for me, upon who's forgiven in ways that stain and burden don't. Morally, you're forgiven if you forgive others. But what mostly strikes me about the modern relevance of this idea of sin as debt is that it's not even metaphorical. I'm pointing to the way that our modern society deals with debt forgiveness, as governed by bankruptcy laws. So you'll be able to go, you know, this afternoon, you'll say, what was the sermon on? It was on bankruptcy. Bankruptcy law is designed to cancel the debts of overburdened debtors and to give them a fresh start. Every modern economy has a form of bankruptcy law, and they're standing in a long tradition of civilization that goes back at least as far as that Jubilee year in Leviticus. Actually, it goes back farther than that. Now, bankruptcy laws can be either more debtor or creditor friendly, making it easier or harder for a debtor to discharge his debts. And the laws discriminate between different kinds of debtors, making it easier for some kinds of debtors to shed their debts than others. And these bankruptcy laws can also differentiate between different kinds of creditors, ensuring that some are paid before others. We have some people who know far more about this in the congregation, and maybe they will correct me after after the sermon too. The point is, in 2005, just as subprime mortgages were starting to boom, Congress passed a new bankruptcy law, still referred to that way, the new bankruptcy law. It's been, what, almost 11 years now. It's still in effect. It's called the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act. That law has far more severe provisions against bankruptcy abuse than it does against consumer protection, I can assure you. In lobbying for the act, the financial industry explicitly argued that consumers should be held responsible for living beyond their means, and that barriers and restrictions were needed to prevent individuals from abusively getting out of their debts through bankruptcy. The new law also introduced a system that basically amounted to partial indentured servitude. An individual with, say, debts equal to 100% of his income could be forced to hand over to the bank 25% of his gross pre-tax income for the rest of his life. This is because the bank was allowed to add on to what a person owed interest, fees, and penalties that could be equivalent to 30% each year. And in the end, the mortgage holder or the consumer credit debt holder would owe far more than the bank had loaned. The debtor could end up working, in effect, one quarter of his time for the bank. Now, studies have shown that the actual causes of individual debt default are not so much fraud and abuse, but inflated housing debt, we've all sort of seen that happen, and medical bills. Student loans are actually sort of looming more and more as a concern, especially from for-profit schools offering questionable educational value. The problem is not just that the new bankruptcy law is draconian for consumer debtors. Together with other laws, the new bankruptcy law is designed in a huge difference between individual consumer bankruptcy and business bankruptcy. So the new law draws an important distinction between consumer debt and business debt. Bankruptcy liquidation of consumer debt is far more difficult and much more limited than liquidation of business debt. Working families trying to get out from under their debts get treated much worse than businesses under bankruptcy laws. Teresa Gagliarducci, who is chair of the economics department at the New School for Social Research, says individuals responsible for corporations, that is the executives, are largely protected from any of the costs of business failures. Whereas an individual who gets into debt, they're presumed to pay most of the cost back. The bankruptcy laws presume that an individual was stupid or immoral, both in getting into debt and in trying to get out of it via bankruptcy. But business enterprises are presumed to get into bankruptcy situations through no fault of their own. Actually, it gets more interesting because big businesses actually count on using the bankruptcy system to shift their debts onto blameless parties. Bankruptcy is actually a standard business practice for some firms. Corporations, says Gagliarducci, often use bankruptcy as contingency strategies in their business model. And it's the people who didn't have any role in the corporation bankruptcies who pay the price, whether they're employees, pensioners, customers, or taxpayers, not the executive officers who are responsible. To top this off, the privileged treatment of business debt even, or especially, maybe we would say, applies to banks and hedge funds and traders, all those people who caused the financial crisis of 2008 and who were at the same time foreclosing on mortgages and taking consumers to collections. So there have been a couple surprises for me as I've worked on this sermon, and maybe for you as you've listened. One is that I could get so interested in the biblical book of Leviticus. The other more serious surprise is how our new bankruptcy laws could not only catch my interest, but get me so worked up and indignant. I mean, if you want to keep your blood at a boiling temperature, just read some of this stuff. It's not just that the law is so obstructive and so crushing for ordinary people struggling with debt. It's also that the legislative process and the arguments that were made the motives of the financial industry so clear. It doesn't take a lot of interpretation. It's not subtle. They gave testimony. These guardians of financial rectitude were explicitly, not, you know, symbolically or covertly, explicitly saying, these little people we have in collections just don't know how to live within their means. Not mentioning that the means might be minimum wage jobs or unemployment benefits. So these people, they just live a profligate life and run up debts. And then they try to get out of their debts by declaring bankruptcy. So we want bankruptcy reformed so that we can continue to grab them by the throat and say, pay up, you deadbeat. 3 years after this law was passed, in 2008, There was a financial crisis, largely caused and precipitated by the financial industry. If you go back and look at the news stories at that time, you'll see they sang a different song when the debt was theirs. I guess I'll just conclude by saying I can hardly think of a case in our time that more clearly and strongly illustrates the moral relevance of what Jesus meant when he taught us to pray. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors.